And our special guest tonight, live from Eastern Europe, Stephen Browdy, as we talk about his work on the other side. And we'll talk more about that with Stephen when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, tell us a little bit about your investigations, some of the things you've done and the ones that have really fascinated you.
Well, as we discussed earlier, I've been interested in the varieties of large-scale physical phenomena, table levitations, things of that sort. And recently I found out about a spiritist seance group in Germany, not too far from Frankfurt, that has been getting phenomena very similar to the classic spiritualist or spiritist phenomena that we saw during the heyday of spiritualism. And this is a group that has been reporting things like not just table levitations, but so-called ectoplasm, this material emerging from various parts of the medium. And this is something that happened quite a bit during the heyday of spiritualism. So the group that I investigated is called the Felix Circle.
You can Felix find Circle? Out.
Okay. Felix Circle, yes. They have a website. You can easily go to that. And the group was founded in 2005. And originally they were focused on the table tilting kind of phenomena. They wanted to duplicate the sorts of phenomena that investigators have been reporting for quite some time. And during the 1970s, a number of investigators were experimenting more or less formally with group sittings like this. And they concluded that you could produce these phenomena relatively easily if you had a bunch of people sitting around not taking it all very seriously, singing songs, telling jokes. And the idea behind that was that if you did this, that no one person would feel particularly invested in success or failure. And it also allowed people not to worry about being solely responsible for the phenomena. So you were, as it were, diffusing responsibility for the phenomena and not taking it all too seriously. And they found that this was one way of getting these phenomena to happen. So that's what the group was doing initially. And now it's evolved into something more like a classical spiritist phenomena where one medium sits in a curtained off area, which is traditionally called a cabinet, and then various things happen. So for example, a rolled up paper trumpet will float around the room. Lights will appear in various parts of the room. Rapping sounds, knocking sounds will appear in all corners of the room. And things will start coming out of the medium, these ectoplasmic-like protrusions. So I learned about this group and got a grant to investigate it with a colleague friend of mine in Vienna, Peter Mulasch. And the grant helped pay for some Zerolux infrared camcorders. And what we wanted to do was to investigate the phenomena and try to record some of these things happening in darkness. Mm-hmm. Because like many of the traditional spiritist groups, they were getting these phenomena in total darkness.
Right. You turn the lights on, for some reason it won't work.
Now, whether that's just part of the belief system or whether it really makes a difference, I'm inclined to think it's just part of the belief system because, again, the best cases of mediumship have not been in total darkness. That's why they're the best cases. So we know darkness is not essential. But if people believe that it is or that it really helps, then it may, in fact, help in those cases. So there are two main people involved in the Felix group right now. There's the medium, and then there's somebody who's nominally treated as the circle leader. And they both know a lot about the old spiritualist or spiritist literature. They've read it very carefully. They know what the standard phenomena are, and they're really into it. And my gut reaction is that they're sincerely into it, that this is not fraudulent. I also have to say that that's my gut reaction. And when I think about my history of failed marriages, I also have to be a little skeptical about my gut reaction. So,
well, sometimes you're perceptive at something and not others. That happens.
I understand that. So, in any case, they tend to get the phenomena in darkness. So my colleague Peter and I went to Germany to meet with them. what we wanted to do, of course, was to be able to use our infrared camcorders and video record as much as we could. Now, the medium and the circle leader told us that they were concerned about using the camcorders. They were concerned about two things, and I think both were completely reasonable. First of all, they were concerned about introducing two new investigators to this group. This is a group that's been together for a long time. They knew each other. They were comfortable with each other. And, you know, it changes the psychodynamics when you bring in just one investigator, and when you bring in two, it changes it even more profoundly. So they were concerned that that might inhibit the phenomenon.
Okay, well, justified, right?
Right, right. They were also concerned from experience, because they've tried this, about trying to record the phenomena. They had found in the past that when they tried to do it, the phenomena either didn't happen or were less dramatic. And so Peter and I figured that at least for our first investigation, we just wanted to see what they were up to, what they were getting, what kind of phenomena they were getting. And then we figured after we got comfortable with the group and they got comfortable with us and we saw what they were doing, then we would introduce tighter and tighter controls as they would allow. And the medium and the circle leader said that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to build up to a point where we could video record as much as possible. So we had two sittings with them. We had a traditional cabinet.
And how many people are sitting around?
Well, in the cabinet sitting, there were 13 of us, including the medium. And the medium was in this curtained-off area, the cabinet. And we saw quite a lot. I mean, there was a lot of interesting stuff that happened on that one. There were some wind chimes that were suspended above the group. And the first thing that happened was, in total darkness, we heard the wind chimes moving a little bit. We had been told that this was sometimes a precursor to the phenomena. And then there were rapping sounds, knocking sounds, very loud, occurring and moving very swiftly around the room. For example, behind me, and there, I was seated. This was a small room in the basement of what's really a bomb shelter.
So you're witnessing this. When this is happening, you're there.
I'm there.
All right.
Now, this is total darkness, okay? But there was no place behind me for somebody to be producing those raps, and they were in the ceiling. They were moving very quickly around the room. We were holding hands at this point, and I was wearing a short sleeve shirt, and I felt touches on my arm. I can tell you that the touches didn't feel like flesh.
Just like pressure?
I would say, well, certainly pressure, but when I was trying to figure out what kind of substance was touching me, it felt more cloth-like than anything else. It didn't feel warm. It didn't feel moist. It just felt solid. So I don't know what to make of that, but it happened.
If you were to have grabbed it, would you have felt anything?
I don't know. We were asked to keep our hands to ourselves. We were also holding hands there. We were also asked to keep our legs tucked in under the
table.
Chairs.
Yeah.
Now, I'll get to that in a minute, because when you're trying to figure out whether there's reason for suspicion here, we need to come to grips with that.
Okay.
But let me go through the rest of the phenomena. They also had, in the center of the room, a little conga drum, and on top of that was a luminous plaque, which they charged with light ahead of time. And every so often, we would see these finger-like protrusions, or at least shadows of them, or outlines of them on the plaque. And sometimes they were coming from my direction. Now, the medium was seated at right angles to me, so he was quite a distance away. So I'm not sure whose fingers those might have been, and they didn't look like human fingers anyway. A folded handkerchief was placed on the plaque, and every so often, these finger-like things would apparently move the handkerchief off the luminous plaque. Okay, so that kind of stuff happened. There were a few of those incidents. Then they took the conga drum and the plaque away, and they put this small, very lightweight trumpet. And at the large end of the trumpet was a luminous strip, so we could always see where the location of the trumpet was. And in the darkened room, the trumpet lifted, moved around the room, with the large end pointing toward sitters individually. So it wasn't as if it was moving from a fixed pivot position. It was actually moving around the room, and it came very close to my face, and the other sitters said it came very close to their face. I actually thought it was going to touch me. I would estimate that it came within an inch of my face.
Did it look like it was under control?
Yes, very much.
Right.
Okay. And then finally, there were the ectoplasm phenomena. And here's how that worked. we were instructed by the medium's control personality to count backwards from 15. And at 5, the circle leader turned on a red light. And at that point, the medium lifted back the curtains, and we saw coming out of his mouth a hand, and I'd say 7 or 8 inches of arm or wrist or whatever you want to say that the hand was attached to. It was coming out of his mouth. Okay, it was a whitish hand. We didn't get to touch it. We saw it only for a few seconds, and then the light was turned off. Then we were asked to count backwards again from 15, and at 5, the light was turned on again. And at that point, the hand was now on the floor, and it was attached to the medium's mouth by a very long extension.
Jeez.
Yeah. Very cool. Just a classic,
very weird.
Classic spiritualist phenomena, absolutely. Then the light was turned off again, and we counted backwards from 15, and the light was turned on again at 5, and this time there was nothing coming out of the medium's mouth, but there was a large white hand on his left shoulder, and it was moving. Didn't look like a human hand. And now I have to say we didn't get a chance to examine the cabinet afterwards to see if there was something hidden there or stashed there, although we did examine the premises in the room, and to some extent we looked at the medium, but not as carefully as we would have liked to. There were some other people there, some more familiar sitters who were controlling the medium.
Was there any point that you doubted their honesty at all?
I have no positive reasons to do that.
Okay.
So I need to be very cautious about what I say about this phenomenon.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I don't have any reasons for any positive reasons for distrusting it, but I don't have any positive reasons for trusting it either.
It's mixed.
My goodness. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I would have to just withhold judgment about that.
Understand.
The table tilting seance that we had a couple of days later was another story, because there we set up our infrared camcorders, and there were two. The table tilting seance was broken into two sessions, of each about 45 minutes. The idea originally was to have the camcorders operating in the second session, and to do the first one totally in the darkness with no controls whatsoever, just so we could see the kind of stuff that they get. And what they said they had been getting in table tilting seances was complete table levitations, the table going very high in the air, and spirit lights, as they called them, appearing in and around the room. So inadvertently, we had one of the camcorders turned on during the first part of the first session. So we have actually quite a lot of video recording of large-scale table movements in the room.
And
so that's
you,
very nice.
And did you try to figure out, okay, how are they doing this?
Well, let me back up just a little. We had, again, two camcorders. One was focused under the table. One was looking from above. From the angles that we had there, we didn't see anything suspicious, but we didn't see everybody's hand.
Right.
Although
right.
I think when you look at it very carefully, the table movements that we saw, some of them were quite large, and the table was moving very vigorously this entire period. I think if the room hadn't been so small, the table would have moved out of the room.
Stephen, if these people were hoaxing it, what were they trying to gain? Anything?
Well, they certainly weren't initially going after any kind of notoriety. The medium has finally accepted that he can't keep his identity totally a secret. But I don't think he, personally, my gut reaction, and we take that with a grain of salt, my gut reaction is that he's not after this for personal glory of any kind. I personally trust the guy. The circle leader is a quite well-known cardiologist in Germany. I think it would actually not be in his interest to reveal his identity. So I don't think he's hoaxing. I don't think he has anything to get out of this. He has more to lose than anything else.
He's just very curious about this phenomenon.
Yes, he is. Now, during the darkened, the totally darkened and non-video recorded portion of the table tilting seance, we got a complete table levitation. And that was really interesting because although it was in darkness, you could tell the table levitated. First of all, the table wasn't tilting. You could tell from the position of your hands above the table. Both Peter and I, who were not seated next to each other,
very pure,
were quite clear about that the table was parallel to the floor. The
yeah.
tabletop was parallel to the floor. And it felt completely different. It felt as if the table just floated up, as if it was weightless. And it didn't feel like it was pushed. It didn't feel like it was being manipulated. And it raised, I'd say, several inches and remained there for several seconds. And everybody responded in a lot of surprise simultaneously. It was as if everybody said, whoa, you know, this was different.
It had the wow factor,
cool.
didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that was very good.
How would you rate these folks in terms of performing at a seance? And I don't mean performing like a show, but with what they do. I mean, would you say they were very good at what they do?
Well, I think it's a very impressive group. What I like about them is that the medium and the circle leader, unlike lots of spiritualist groups, I mean, there's a lot of the stuff being reported going on. But most of the convinced spiritualists, excuse me, who do this aren't particularly concerned about trying to get good evidence. They're not very sympathetic to people who want to come in and try to control the phenomena and record it. The Felix Circle, by contrast, wants to get, so they say, the best documented evidence of these kinds of phenomena ever obtained. And so I'm encouraged by this because they want us to come back. They want us to continue to increase the degree of control. And so I'm hoping we can get funding to do that.
How would you rate them compared to other places you've been? As good? Better?
I'd say better. But let me just back up again about this, because remember, there are some things that if you want to play devil's advocate, you just have to wonder about. Okay.
Of
For
course.
Example, in the cabinet seances, remember, the sitters were asked to be noisy to encourage the phenomena. Now, of course, noise could mask the movement of someone producing the rapping sounds. Noise could also mask the movement of someone carrying the trumpet around. So there was room in the middle of the circle for a person to walk around within the circle if they knew the dimensions of the room very well. But I'll tell you about that, about the trumpet. What impresses me about the trumpet phenomena is that how could somebody have managed to come so close to the sitters' faces in total darkness without touching them?
And you know, you can feel people in darkness. You know when they're there. This is amazing that nobody felt anybody.
That's true.
I mean, you can even hear the sound of people breathing.
Well, there was music playing. People were excited and talking, and you know, they were singing along with the music. So that's.
You think that masked it?
Potentially. I mean, again, if you're playing devil's advocate, you have to wonder about that. You have to wonder about the fact that we were asked to tuck in our legs, not to reach out into the circle. Ostensibly, that was to avoid disturbing the force or disturbing the process.
Or tripping somebody.
Exactly right. Now, I have to say there, though, on the other hand, that the medium's heavy breathing and talking from within the cabinet was usually audible during the phenomenon.
Well, and again, Stephen, you got to think about where's the gain here. You know, whenever anything happens, I've always said, who benefits? Who profits? There doesn't seem to be any profit here other than trying to get to the truth. Let's come back and talk about one of your other works called Immortal Remains. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll take your calls next hour with Stephen, maybe even some of your stories. I can't wait to get into Immortal Remains when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, tell me about your work, Immortal Remains, which, of course, is the evidence for life after death. Tell me about your work there.
Well, it was a book that I wrote because I was becoming more chronologically challenged, and I figured the time had come to come to grips with the evidence for survival of bodily death. And I had just finished a book on multiple personality and the philosophy of mind. And the reason I wrote that one first was because a great deal of the evidence for survival of bodily death, from mediumship in particular, looks a lot like what you see in many cases of dissociation or multiple personality. So I realized I couldn't do a decent job of examining the evidence for survival unless I knew quite a lot about the history of psychiatry and hypnosis and dissociation. And I wanted to address the issue in the way that I think most researchers wanted to address the issue, and that is see whether there's some way of examining the evidence that would appeal to an open-minded but scientifically inquisitive investigator. And so I was asking myself, well, if it's not survival, what is it? And the way I looked at it was that if we're trying to explain away the evidence, which I think is one way to approach it, the options are these. First of all, there are what we could call the usual suspects. That is, we could try to explain the evidence from mediumship or reincarnation or whatever as due to mistakes in observation or mistakes in reporting or fraud or hidden memories.
Sure.
Now, obviously, there are better cases that the usual suspects just don't touch whatsoever. So we can forget about the usual suspects. But then you're left with what we could call the unusual suspects. And here's where, for me, all of this got really interesting, and it connects with my interest in multiple personality, because another way to look at these cases is as examples of people exhibiting rare or abnormal processes, like a combination of dissociation and latent creative abilities, or exceptional memory, or extreme or rare forms of savantism or something like that, or then possibly just living agent psychic functioning. And these aren't just purely academic questions, because there are some cases that look so good initially as evidence for survival, but when you look closely at them, you see something quite different. So one of the cases that interests me a lot is this case of patient's worth. And this is from the early 20th century in the U.S. This is about a St. Louis housewife named Pearl Curran, who had an eighth grade education, some musical abilities, but certainly was not widely read, didn't know much about the Bible or ancient history or really much at all. And she started channeling through a Ouija board, a personality who claimed to have lived in England in the 17th century named Patience Worth. And this Patience Worth personality, through Pearl, produced 29 volumes of written material that are now in the Missouri Historical Society in St. Louis. This included like half a dozen novels, some plays, thousands and thousands of poems improvised on the spot, and lots of very witty discussions, and a personality quite different from that of Pearl. And what's particularly interesting about this is the quality of the literature and the extreme fluency of this creativity. Pearl could improvise poems on the spot on any topic presented to her. The poems were fantastic in many cases. She could produce stunts of composition that I think, as far as I know, are unprecedented in literary history. So, for example, at one point, somebody asked her to write a poem, each line of which began with a different letter of the alphabet going from A to Z. They said, you can leave out X. And then there was a pause of a few seconds, and the poem came out as quickly as the stenographer could write it down. Another thing about this case is that Pearl would write these poems or the novels in an archaic Anglo-Saxon dialect that actually had never been spoken, that was a mixture of dialects from several different centuries and included words that even scholars of the time had to work hard to trace down and find out that they were legitimate words.
Could it be reincarnation?
Well, except it's not clear. It wasn't. There was a consistent personality through them all, but not linked to any particular time. There's no real evidence of survival. There is no information that comes from this that links the persona of Patience Worth to anybody in the past. This has been actively researched. I spent a long time going through the Mormon records to see who came from the U.S. at this particular period of time when Pearl says she came over to the U.S. from Dorset in England and was killed by Indians. But that's about all we know about her. There's no record of anybody named Patience Worth, much less anybody with these kinds of literary abilities. And, another reason for not linking her to any particular time is, although she said she was from the 17th century, one of the novels that she wrote was a Victorian novel, and which postdated the time when Pearl said she lived. And actually, the publisher of this book had a sense of humor. He said, this is a mid-Victorian novel by a pre-Victorian author. Go ahead.
Well, why do you think it's so difficult to pin down evidence and proof?
One of the reasons is that it's almost impossible, in principle, almost impossible, to distinguish evidence of survival from evidence of psychic functioning by the living. And that's because, for reasons we discussed earlier, if you're communicating through a medium with the spirit, you're already involved in psychic functioning on the other side.
That's true.
And if a medium gives you verifiable evidence, if a medium says, Uncle Harry's with me now, he wants you to know that he had a secret will that he hid in a secret compartment in his desk. All right. Now, suppose no living person knows that.
Right. Or he's got money in his mattress or something.
Right. And then suppose we find it. Well, if it was there to be verified normally, then it was there to be accessed by clairvoyance, by ESP.
Right.
So you've got a kind of stalemate that's really hard to break through. And unfortunately, we have some really interesting cases, but no case that is such a slam dunk case that only the most rigid and intellectually dishonest people would say that we don't have evidence for survival.
And Stephen, you know, whether it is telepathy, life after death, whatever the belief system might be, remote viewing, it still convinces you that there's something out there in this universe or multiverses that is unusual, that we truly can't explain yet, and that it is all, I think, directly tied in with each other.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I'm becoming increasingly convinced about is that we need to look more at evidence provided by children rather than by adults whose belief systems are already polluted. A good example of this is from a recent body of material we have suggesting survival. And these are the transplant cases. You know about these? These are where heart-lung recipients start taking on personality characteristics of the donors whom they don't know. And some of these cases are really fascinating. So, for example, there's one case of a young man who received a heart-lung transplant from a lesbian painter. And his girlfriend reports that after the surgery, her boyfriend went through some really remarkable changes. First of all, he suddenly had an interest in art, which he never did before. He would spend hours in art galleries. He started carrying a purse. And he started making love to her in ways which he never did before, and displayed a knowledge of female anatomy that was completely new. Now, so there are lots of cases like that, but what interested me most was one where there was a young boy who received a heart-lung transplant from another young boy, and he describes what's going on quite differently from the grown-ups, because where it looks as if in the case of the adults, you've got some kind of possession or something like that. The young boy described what was going on as if the previous personality, the donor, was with him all the time. He said sometimes he would just let Jerry take over.
Was it possession to the point of being evil, or was it good?
No. It's just as if, see, the way I look at these transplant cases is that it's like a sort of haunting case, except where instead of the previous personality hovering around a location, they're hovering around their former vital organs, which are still living. And the case that most strongly suggests that is this case of the young boy, because he describes the donor as being there with him all the time, whereas the adults never say anything like that. The adults just start taking on personality characteristics of the donor. The child doesn't. The child hasn't already been conditioned to have certain beliefs about what is or is not possible.
Right, right.
And So there's a very touching moment in the child's case where he's finally introduced to the parents of the donor. And what observers saw was that the child ran up to the parents of the donor and nuzzled up to them in the way in which the now deceased child used to do. It meant a great deal to the parents of the donor, but where what the little boy described as happening, he said he just let Jerry take over at that point.
That is something. That is something. Of course, you know, they have said that under donor organs, cadaver parts, that sometimes memory is passed on. So
well,
maybe there's a lot, you know, this interconnection again keeps coming up, doesn't it, Stephen?
It does. I mean, I think a lot of people look at these transplant cases and they want to explain it in terms of something like cellular memory. Now, I don't want to get too abstractly philosophical here. I have a problem with the very concept of cellular memory. I think it literally makes no sense. But it's, again, one of the reasons I think the child's case is quite different, because it suggests it's not like that at all. It's as if the donor remains present in some sense.
Of all this work that you've gone through, you're convinced there's something on the other side, no doubt, right? I'm not going to ask you about why yet, but you do believe it exists.
Some days I do, some days I don't.
Do you wrestle with yourself about this?
Absolutely, continually. I mean, it depends whether I'm wearing my human being hat or my
scientist hat. If it doesn't exist, what do you think happens when one dies?
It's at this point that I become the world's worst radio interview, okay? Because I literally don't know what to say. I wish I could answer that question. I wrote the book hoping to answer that question, and I came away increasingly impressed by just how remarkable living human beings are.
But I would assume that if you don't believe in life after death, that you have to say that when you die, that's it. It's over. It's done.
Well, that would be the upshot, yeah. And I don't want to believe that, and I admit that freely. And I'm at that personal stalemate about it.
At the top of the hour, I was talking about the fact that every listener, I'm not trying to be morbid about it here, this is just the fact, it's the truth. Every listener, and you can take it to the bank, is going to die one day. And, you know, some in the next few weeks, some in years to come, but it's going to happen to everybody. And I think once people begin to realize that their own mortality is close, it changes their perception in their views. They become hungry to find out what's going on the other side. And it gets to a point where it becomes intriguing to think of the possibilities of what's out there. I know that's happening to me, Stephen.
Well, it's happened to me for some time, and I understand that completely, and it's why I hope there's more to life than this apparently mortal existence that we have. And in most of my moments, I'm inclined to believe that there is. I take the testimony of people who've had remarkable experiences very seriously. I also understand the perspective of scientists who want to look at this more objectively and ask, well, how can we accept the survival hypothesis and positively rule out the living agent psychic functioning hypothesis? I think it's very difficult to do, and I respect that question. I don't think that all the people who ask that question are just deniers. I think a lot of the people who ask that question sincerely are open to the evidence, but are approaching it from a certain kind of perspective, which is legitimate, but which may be completely limited in this context. It may be that it's one of those questions that can't be answered by science in any way that's utterly satisfying.
You know, just over the weekend, there was a former hockey player who died, Bob Probert. He played for the Red Wings and the Chicago Blackhawks. Died of a heart attack, 45 years old. And, I mean, I'm sure he woke up in the morning thinking he was going to have a great time. He was with his wife and kids and his family. They were boating. And you go just like that, Stephen. What can people do to prepare for the possibility of the existence of the other side? While you're still alive, is there anything we can do? Is there anything we should do?
I wish I knew how to answer that. I'm not sure I know what to do to prepare for tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I say that from here in Serbia, where the question is more than just academic interest.
The theologians say you should be good, you know, if you want to go to heaven. But I don't know about that yet, you know?
No, I don't either.
I think
I mean,
it's,
I don't know what I'm going to come back as if a certain view of things is right. I worry that I'm going to come back as a urinary tract infection, frankly.
Well, that would be a pleasant thought, wouldn't it?
I get not very spiritually evolved, but I suppose I get to travel.
But don't worry, Stephen. There are antibiotics, so you'll be okay in one way or another.
So I appreciate the question you're asking, and it's a very serious question, and I wish I knew how to answer it for myself. It's something I wrestle with constantly.
And I think a lot of people do, don't you? We'll find out when we get the phone calls.
Presumably, yes.
How do you look when you were doing your research? What baffled you the most? So there had to be something out there that just puzzled the heck out of you.
Well, the cases puzzle the heck out of me. I mean, the cases are remarkable. There are some fantastic cases. I'll just give you one easy to describe example.
Sure.
It's called a Dutch bookkeeper case. Let me think how I can start this one for you. There was a clerk in the Netherlands about 50 years ago, I think. He died unable to explain a large deficit in his books. It looked like he had embezzled from his employer. And the poor man went to his grave protesting his innocence. After he died, his son had an apparition of a white figure telling him to check the dates in the ledger. The son looked at the dates in the ledger, and he found out that a date at the top of one of the columns had mistakenly been added into the sums below. And that was the exact amount
that was off.
The clerk who had allegedly embezzled, okay? Now, there may be no paranormal explanation required for what went on, but if a paranormal explanation is required, then it's clairvoyance, no matter what.
The ghost did not want to go to his grave being accused of embezzling money.
Right. But so the question is, how was that information discovered? Either the son got the information by clairvoyance or the deceased father did. I mean, the deceased father didn't have a body that allowed him to read the ledger. He didn't know this when he died, because if he knew this when he died or when he was dying, he would have said, check the ledger.
See, I don't think you can have one without the other. I don't think you could have clairvoyance without the other side. I think all of it's mixed together. Stephen, let's talk about that briefly, then we'll take phone calls for the entire hour when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.